I wanted to start by quickly touching on some of the headlines this week on Capitol Hill, and beginning with the House GOP bill to repeal and replace Obamacare. As we're speaking now Friday morning, it appears there will be debate and a vote sometime later today, perhaps late afternoon. But what I wanted to ask you is, what does the difficulty that the GOP leadership and President Trump have had wrangling the needed votes in a GOP-controlled House say to you about the fate of this bill ultimately and the future of Obamacare?
Mm-hmm. What the House is doing, again, on a controversial and difficult issue, is trying to pass major legislation that is not even close to being bipartisan. I don't think there's going to be a single Democrat that will vote for it. And in the within the Republican caucus, they have the moderates who are opposed to it. There are not a lot of them, but several dozen. You've got the sort of the Tea Party folks, the Freedom Caucus, and they appear to be opposed to it. And then somehow the Republicans under the leadership of Paul Ryan are trying to cobble together a majority of 218 votes, and with no Democratic support, and with a badly splintered Republican majority, it's a hard thing to do. In Delaware, we're pretty good at the three C's: communicate, compromise, collaborate. And this is an issue that just cries out for that. And my hope is that when the House votes on Friday afternoon, that they will not pass what they appear to be coming up with. When Donald Trump was running for president, he said, if elected, that he would make sure that we'd provide health care for everybody. It would be better health care, better quality health care. It would be more affordable. And he said that as a candidate, as a president-elect. He said it as president as well. But if you actually drill down on what the House appears to be poised to offer, the Congressional Budget Office, which is neither Democrat nor Republican, they're nonpartisan. They have a lot of smart people who work there. They're led by a fellow who's actually Republican, chosen by Republican leadership of the Congress. But Congressional Budget Office tells us that everybody won't be covered, and rather like 14 million people in the next year or two will lose their coverage, and another 6-8 million beyond that in the years to follow. The one of the things they do agree on is that there would be a very substantial tax cut that flows from this legislation. Some people say it's a health care reform mass. It's tax cut for very wealthy people earning over $250,000 as a couple, masquerading as health care reform. So there's it's just interesting to see that undercurrent that's going on here. And the state of Delaware, which is facing a big budget deficit, Governor Carney has a very tough job in taking the reins of leadership, trying to fill a hole, $380 million hole here in the state of Delaware. And the state spending for Medicaid, and that's Medicaid is a healthcare program is for a lot of people think it's for low income people. It is, but most of the spending on Medicaid is not for poor families, mostly women and children. Most of the money we spend in Medicaid is for older people who have spent up their resources. Mm-hmm. They're old. They have little income, and they can't take care of themselves, and they end up in nursing homes. That's where we spend most of the money in Medicaid these days, and. Under what's proposed by the Republicans, was a really a strong partnership between the federal government and the state would be shifted more and more to the states and make the budget dilemma we have here in Delaware even more difficult. So, does that suggest the Affordable Care Act is perfect? No, it isn't. Actually, it's founded on Republican principles that come out of the Heritage Foundation two and a half decades ago, where. They proposed ideas that became the alternative to Hillary Care in 1993. Didn't go anywhere until about 2003, 10 years later. Mitt Romney, governor of Massachusetts, took those same ideas, exchanges or marketplaces in each state, the idea that we had a sliding scale tax credit to buy down the cost of health care for lower income people. And when their income goes up, eventually the tax credit goes away. The idea of an individual mandate that says, everybody, look, we want you to have, want everybody to have health care coverage. And if you don't get it, then you have to pay a fine. Romney Care also said in Massachusetts that the employers of a certain size, a certain number of employees, you got to provide health care for your folks. And also said to insurers, if you got people who in the state who have pre-existing condition, you cannot deny or throw them off of coverage. Those are all elements of the original Republican proposal in 93 in the Congress, Mitt Romney in Massachusetts. And actually, it's the underpinning of the Affordable Care Act. And which is, there's a real irony there. The stuff that the Affordable Care Act and my Republican colleagues in Washington most dislike is their ideas from 25 years ago. There's a real irony there. I don't think they see it, but there is.
I do want to move on to the confirmation hearing for Supreme Court nominee Neil Gorsuch. That was obviously a marathon this week. What did you take away from all of that? And will you filibuster a vote on Judge Gorsuch?
What I've said to anyone who's asked me this week in Washington, reporters asked me how do I feel about the Gorsuch nomination. What I say is I don't believe we should move forward on the Gorsuch nomination until we have dealt with fairly with the nomination of Merrick Garland, highly regarded jurist, highly regarded by Republicans and by Democrats, nominated by former President Obama, with almost a year to go on President Obama's term, and Republicans declined to even, for the most part, meet with Merrick Garland, denied him even a hearing, the courtesy of a hearing. I thought the way he was treated was shameful. He would have been a great Supreme Court justice. And I'm not prepared to consider the nomination of Mr. Gorsuch until we also agree to reconsider, to actually finally to consider the nomination of Merrick Garland. And my hope is at some point down the line later this year, we can perhaps consider both of them almost simultaneously. And I think confirm both of them. But to move forward on Judge Gorsuch right now, with just kind of ignore what happened, you know, for the last year with Merrick Garland, I think would be wrong. There's a great wrong was committed against him, I think against our country, against the Constitution, and that needs to be righted. That wrong needs to be righted. And we can do that, and if we're willing to do that, then I think the nomination of Mr. Gorsuch can go forward as well.
I want to move on to the Trump budget and hit a number of different areas one at a time. One of the areas you've been especially vocal about are cuts that would impact the environment, especially the EPA, zeroing out the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program. And the Trump administration has kind of couched this as an effort to return these efforts to protect the environment back to state and local governments. But I guess the question I have is that likely to happen? And I asked that in the kind of the frame of a couple years ago, former Governor Markell tried to get legislation passed to fund a cleanup of Delaware's waterways to no avail. And that was in better budget times. So it seems like, at least from the Delaware perspective, there would be a disconnect between returning efforts to protect the environment and clean up waterways and such without support from the federal government via the EPA or any of these other programs that are on the chopping block.
Now, the pollution that comes to the East Coast from Virginia all the way up to Maine is air pollution, as a prime example. It does not emanate, it does not begin on the East Coast. It begins in the Midwestern part of our country, where you have utilities largely powered by coal, who burn coal, and they have these tall smokestacks hundreds of feet up in the air. They put their emissions way up into the atmosphere. The winds, the westerly prevailing winds, blow that pollution, carbon dioxide, sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxide, mercury, which portends bad things for our health and for our environment, and it sends it to us. We're at the end of America's tailpipe here. When I was governor, I could have shut down Delaware's economy, closed pretty much all of our factories and plants and stuff, ordered all the cars, trucks, vans off the road, and we would still have air pollution problems, significant ones, because 90% of our pollution in Delaware comes from other states. There's been a long-standing legislative battle to try to do something about that. We've been unable to do that because of the opposition of the utilities, especially the coal industry. And the opposition of some of the polluting states. Mm-hmm. They get cheap electricity. They put the pollution up in the air. It comes not on them but on us. So they get cheap electricity, more affordable health care. We end up having to scrub, double scrub, you know, and clean up our environment and our air even more. It costs us a lot of money. and we have poor health care outcomes because of the pollution that comes from these other states. It is wrong. It's a direct violation of the golden rule. Is this treating other people the way you'd like to be treated? So there's a regulation proposed by the Obama administration. It's called cross-border rule. But the idea is to say to states, you can't just willy-nilly send your pollution up in the air and foul the air and harm the health of your neighbor. So the very premise on which these cuts of EPA would say, well, let's just let states do what they want to do. Well, it turns out air pollution does not recognize borders. Water pollution does not recognize borders. Our friends over here in Maryland with the Chesapeake Bay, they, for a number of years, Delaware was not a good neighbor. And we take poultry manure out of chicken sheds up and down the state, mostly the southern part of the state. And we'd spread it out on the fields very thickly, and it would rain. Mm-hmm. And the phosphorus and nitrogen in the chicken manure would wash off into the ditches and the streams and the rivers and the lakes, and eventually all over to Chesapeake Bay, and degrade the quality of the Chesapeake Bay, make it hard for people to make a living there anymore. And the same thing. We've cleaned up our act. Mm-hmm. It's been farmer-led. I'm very proud of what's happened. We started my last term as governor. We've made great progress, and we're a much better neighbor than Pennsylvania. On the other hand, they continue to foul and pollute the Chesapeake Bay. That's not right. That's not fair. And again, if you say leave it up to Pennsylvania to fix their problems in order to help their neighbors, they may not do that. That's why we have this federal approach. It's not just the federal government telling states what to do, but it's a partnership with the EPA, with the Delaware Department of Natural Resources and Environmental Control. It's a partnership.
Also, a lot was made of funding for Meals on Wheels, and the administration's argument there was that programs like that we're showing no indication of results. Also, after-school programs, school meal programs. How do you respond to that kind of that idea that some of these programs that are dealing with kids and meals, seniors and meals, need to show a certain level of results to continue to be funded at all?
There's a verse of scripture in the New Testament, Matthew 25, that refers to the least of these. It says, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was thirsty, did you give me a drink? When I was naked, did you clothe me? When I was sick and in prison, did you visit me? When I was a stranger in your land, did you take me in? And I think we have a moral obligation to look out for the least of these. Since we don't have unlimited dollars, unlimited resources at the federal level or at the state level, what we need to do is to find ways to meet that moral obligation of the least of these in cost-effective ways. I believe we do that. I delivered Meals on Wheels about a week ago in Sussex County, Georgetown. The fellow that we visited in his 80s, he was in Vietnam way before I was in Southeast Asia. He was a naval flight officer in the early 70s. So he was there more than a decade before me. And he was in a unit where four out of every five Marines was wounded, many killed. And he still today has psychological challenges that he faces, and he's helped by the VA on that. He and other people are alive today, in no small part because every day, 5 days a week, a volunteer, not a paid person, a volunteer, brings a meal, maybe two meals, and on weekends a couple of extra meals so that he can get through the weekend. He lives by himself, and he is deeply grateful, tearful, for the help he gets, the care. And why should we take that away? We shouldn't.
As you look broadly at these cuts from the Trump administration, is that a large concern for you that they seem to be more, I guess, kind of paper, numbers on paper related than perhaps related to understanding what's happening on the ground with any of these particular programs?
I was privileged to be treasurer of the state of Delaware before I was ever a congressman or governor. Right after I got out of the Navy, I was 26, moved to Delaware, got an MBA at the University of Delaware, got to be state treasurer almost right out of business school. And I was 29, and we had the worst credit rating in the country. We were tied for dead last with Puerto Rico, and we would always overestimate revenues, underestimate spending. We had no pension fund. We had no cash management system. We were awful, and nobody would lend us any money. And we're the lowest state in the country in terms of small business startups. And Pete DuPont was elected a governor. implement a bunch of good budget reforms. I hope I helped out a bit as treasurer. I think I may have the legislature, Democrats and Republicans, all work together. And we have AAA credit ratings today. We got them when I was governor. My last term as governor, we earned AAA credit ratings, and very proud of all that we accomplished. So I know a little bit about budgeting. Thought a lot about it as a governor, a lot before that as treasurer. What our current president has proposed is very substantial tax cuts, mostly helping wealthier people. A very big buildup of our military. We spend already more money on defense in this country than the last six or seven or eight nations combined. And now we're going to look at another big expenditure in that regard. A lot of spending in infrastructure, transportation infrastructure, and roads, highways, bridges, rail, ports, and all that stuff. Build a wall from along the Mexican border, from sea to shining sea, from the West Coast, from the Pacific to the Gulf Coast, and somehow reduce the deficit, eliminate the deficit. That doesn't work. Those numbers just don't work. They don't add up. And my hope is that some more responsible people who actually understand budgeting, including the Congressional Budget Office, including my colleagues on the House and Senate Budget Committee, will just smell the coffee and say, that just doesn't work. Let's see if we can't work on a more responsible. A bunch of people, Democrats and Republican members of the House and Senators, saying the president's budget is dead on arrival. Well, we'll see. But we do have this system of checks and balances, as we know. Constitution that our forefathers gave us. They set it up so that one of the major things they didn't want to have happen was they didn't want us to have a king. They wanted to set up a system where no one person could amass enormous power. So we set up this system of checks and balances. It can be slow things down. It can be annoying at times. We have the protection for the press, freedom of the press, freedom of speech, freedom of gathering together and peacefully. So it's a hard way to go. And what did Churchill used to say? Democracy is the worst form of government devised by wit of man, except for all the rest.
Having said that, I'm curious if you think there is a concern on your part that this is in somewhat a calculated approach by the administration to shift what would be considered the middle ground. That, for example, you propose defunding the Chesapeake Bay Restoration Program, then come back and compromise at 50%, which would still be a major cut. Do you worry that that's perhaps the calculation that's being made with a budget proposal like this?
Well, I think when you have big budget deficits, which are in this state, and a number of states are in that situation, or in the federal government, we need to look at everything we do, and ask this question. How do we get a better result for less money? Fortunately, there's an outfit called GAO, Government Accountability Office, which has a watchdog, federal watchdog. They have several thousand very good employees, very smart people. And it's nonpartisan, but what they do is they look across the government and they help us identify ways that we're wasting money. And one of the ways they say we're leaving money on the table is in we continue to underfund and reduce the funding for the IRS. We continue to do this. And the Congress changes the tax code, the president changes the tax code late in the calendar year. The IRS has to somehow understand what all the changes mean, be able to message that in internet, over their website, through all the paper they push out the door that explains the tax code. And we don't give them enough money to hire people to explain it or to train their folks. So, but for the GAO tells us, that if we would increase revenue available for hiring and training people at the IRS, that for every dollar we'd spend, we'd get at least four. I've seen estimates as high as $10. And the idea of not further cutting the IRS, does that really make sense? I'm a 23-year Navy veteran, retired Navy captain, Vietnam veteran, love the military, love the Commander-in-Chief of the Delaware National Guard. But having said it, we do spend a lot more money than the next six, seven nations on Earth for defense. And if you ask the General Accountability Office, how is the Department of Defense doing in terms of their own management of their finances? Well, they'll tell you that major weapons systems cost overruns last year were $400 billion, $400 billion. That the Department of Defense, founded in 1947, has never once gotten a clean financial audit. Meanwhile, compared to what? Well, the Department of Homeland Security, which is also a big department, created about a dozen years ago, they, for the last 4 years, have gotten clean audits. They can actually measure. You can manage what you can measure. I'll never forget having a town hall meeting when I was a congressman early in my time as a congressman. We're having a town hall meeting focused on budgeting, the need for spending restraint across the board, and also the needs for some revenue. So I'll never forget a woman in the back of the room. She raised her hand. She says, "Congressman Carper, I don't mind paying some extra taxes. I just don't want you to waste my money." And GAO, every year, beginning of every other year, the beginning of Congress, gives us a high-risk list. And what I've done for years is use that as the leader, Democratic leader of the Senate Committee on Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, to find out how do we reduce waste, eliminate as much of it as we can. And that shouldn't be a Democratic issue or Republican issue. That's just a smart issue.